part of the sheet. So hopefully everyone who had the Shavuos sheet has that as well. We are in the story of Abigail. I don't know if any of you are planning to be at B'nai Torah on the second day of Yom Tov. I don't see Ruth Zimmerman here. I thought she might be there. I'm going to be talking about this story. I'm going to be talking about Abigail, Redeemer of Men. You already know much of what I'm going to say there. I'm going to talk about how she had this pattern of redeeming Naval, and I'm going to talk about how she redeems David, which is, of course, the part of the chapter that we're in now. I'm not going through the entire chapter at this point. I feel bad because we didn't have class last week. I hope people haven't forgotten too much. But since we spent our first half, our first 20 minutes on Shavuos, I want to really jump into this. We saw Abigail attempt to deter David. David's intentions are brutal. He's planning on wiping everybody out. Abigail sends a gift. She follows after the gift. She began by saying, "We are guilty, I am guilty." And we said she may not really mean "I am guilty" because she's not, and because she said she wasn't guilty. She said, "I didn't know what Naval was doing. I didn't know about that." And Naval, she said, is beneath your notice. So, you know, don't pay any attention to him. And then she said, key words that we're going to come back to now, she says, "Hashem saved you from acting on this. Hashem saved you by sending me. Hashem saved you from doing something terrible, from entering into blood." Then she said, "May your enemies be like Naval." We talked about what that may mean. Is she foreseeing the death of her husband? Is that something else? She gave David a bracha, right? A blessing, which may also have included a rebuke, right? She said, "May you never do anything bad," which can be a blessing or it could be a rebuke. Hey, don't do bad things. She said, "May your soul be bound in the bond of life." And we gave different explanations for what that was. And then she concluded by saying, "When you ascend the throne, you will be better off for not having killed Naval. And please remember me," right? In terms of being better off for not having killed Naval, because you'd be in trouble with God if you kill Naval. And also you'd be in trouble with people, right? Shaul would say, "Hey, you think Naval is rebelling against the throne by not helping you? Who do you think is the throne? You're the rebel against the throne." And as Malbim noted also, and Rashi, based on Yerushalmi, if you attack Naval now, you will never be able to punish anybody who committed an act of violence as vengeance. Because everyone's just going to say, "Well, you did it." Not to mention, Abarbanel said, "Avera goeres avera." If you do this, you're going to become a king who finds it easy to kill people in a rage. Don't fall into that trap. And then she said, "Remember me." And we had three explanations for what "remember me" meant. Either it meant, "You're going to be happy that I gave you such good advice. Remember, I'm the one who gave you that good advice." Or alternatively, "Remember me now." Not "remember me later." "Remember me now, and therefore don't destroy my house." In case David is still thinking about violence. And then third was the idea, the prophecy from the Gemara and Megillah, "Remember me when Naval dies." So the last bit that we did was to ask, how is David going to respond to Abigail? What is it about her speech that is going to appeal to David? And we said it was her invocation of Hashem and her ta'am. That's what David fixes on. And we said the word ta'am is advice, which could be her logic, but it could also refer to her prophecy. Remember, we said she is a nevi'ah. She is a prophet. In order to be a prophet, you have to have a target audience. Right? Remember our discussion once about Daniel and whether he was a prophet or not? Daniel can't be a Navi, according to most commentators. Why can't he be a Navi? He certainly had great visions. Yeah, but he had no target audience. Hashem never said to him, "Go tell people." Just the opposite. Hashem said to him, "Don't go tell people." If you're a Navi, it means that there are people Hashem wants to have hear your message. Abigail's audience is David. She is David's Nevi'ah. We're used to thinking of David's Nevi'im as Shmuel, who anointed him, right, and then disappeared. Gad, who told him get out of the Midbar, and is going to have another conversation with him much later on. And Nasan, who's going to rebuke him for Bathsheba and tell him he can't build the Beis HaMikdash. But he also has Abigail as his Nevi'ah. And that's what we were up to. Clear? Okay, we're refreshed? Excellent. I did actually want to note two things. If you look at the top of the source sheet, two things. Number one, I told you last time, because it was Lag BaOmer, when we learned that we saw the bracha that David sent to Naval, Va'amartem Kol Achai, right? And I told you that's a song for Lag BaOmer. So there's a link to a version of the song. And then the other was that Sandra had asked the question last time wanting to know, we talked about David, about the souls of David's enemies being slung in the sling, the Kaf HaKela. So Sandra asked for other uses of it from around Tanakh. So I just wanted to show you there are different kinds of uses. One is, and I think the earliest one probably, the Kla'im in the Mishkan. The Mishkan walls, the outer walls, are braided materials that's called Kla'im, that's what I gave you, Shmo 27. And then in Malachim Aleph, Perek Vav, it's used to describe designs in the walls in the Beis HaMikdash. And then I brought you Yirmiyahu, who talks about slinging things in the Kela. So that's just a note from what we had seen before. Okay. What I want to do now is unpack a really strange Gemara. It's the type of Gemara that you really hesitate before teaching, because it is strange and hard to understand. But I think it's useful because it shows how Chazal viewed, how our sages viewed the relationship between David and Abigail. That's why I think that this is important. So that's it's based on when David says, Baruch ta'amech, your ta'am is blessed. So I gave you one explanation that it means her logic, another explanation that it means her counsel, her prophetic counsel. But ta'am can also mean a legal argument. Abigail, your legal argument is blessed. What in the world does that mean? Take a look at source number one, please, and you'll see what I mean. The following two passages, the Bavli in source number one and the Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi in source number two, describe Abigail showing David a cloth with blood of Nida on it. You know that if a woman experiences Nida blood, so she and her husband are off limits to each other until she goes through a process that culminates in going to mikvah. In the event that there's some uncertainty as to whether it's blood or not, it may need to be examined by an expert. So take a look at source number one. Look at this Gemara. V'hayah yirocheves al hachamor v'yaredes b'seser hahar. She was riding on the donkey and she descended in the hidden part of the mountain, the shadow of the mountain. So the Gemara says, what is this, the hidden part of the mountain? B'seser hahar. Min hahar mibayalei. She descended from the mountain, that's all. Ama Rabba Bar Shmuel. So Rabba Bar Shmuel explains, Al iske dam haba min hastarim. It was about blood that comes from hidden places. Dam nida. Natzla dam behera salo. She took blood and she showed it to David. Amar, as though he's supposed to examine it and see, is this really blood or not? So Amarla, he says to her, Chimarin dam balayla. He says, what are you doing? You don't examine a potential blood stain at night. You don't have proper lighting. So I can't look at this at night. To which Amrlo, she says back to David, and we quoted this part of the Gemara earlier. I just skipped part in order to get to it. Amrlo, she said to him, Chidon in dine nefashos balayla. What, did we deal with capital punishment at night? You're sentencing my husband to death as a rebel against the throne? Amar la, mori b'malchusu, to which David said, he's a rebel against the throne. V'lo tzarech l'midayne, we don't need to try him. Or as Tosfos on the Gemara says, we don't need to try him by day. That can be done at night. Amar lo, she said to David, adayin Shaul kayim v'lo yatza tivacha ba'olam. Shaul is still alive. you're not yet known as the king. You're not minting coins. You can't call him a rebel against the throne. Amar Lot, to which he responded, Uvaruch ta'amech. Blessed be your counsel, your reason, your legal argument is what I think it is here. Ubrucha at asher kilosani hayom hazeh mivova damim. You are blessed because you kept me from entering into damim, blood, today. Damim is plural, it implies two bloods. So according to the Bavli version, and we're going to come back and discuss this, but just according to the Bavli version, this is a strategy that Abigail has thought up. She comes to David knowing she has to figure out a way to stop him cold. So she brings blood for him to look at in order to start the conversation about not judging Naval at night. Clear? I know there are a million questions to ask about the Gemara, but just in terms of what I'm summarizing here, we're good? The Yerushalmi has a different version of this. In the Yerushalmi version, she actually is trying to keep David from asking her to join him after he kills Naval. David's plan is to kill Naval. David is going to ask Abigail to join him, and she is trying to keep him at a distance. Take a look at source number two. Amrale, she says to him, Mari David, my master David, you're coming to kill me? Ana ma'avdis, what have I done? Bonai ma'avdun, what have my children done? Be'irai ma'avid, what have my animals done? Why are you going to kill all of us? Amar lo b'nei shekila malchus David, to which he said, because your husband cursed the monarchy of David. Amar le'u melech ata, she says to him, what, are you a king? Amar lo, to which he said, v'lo mishchani Shmuel melech, didn't Shmuel anoint me? What do you mean, don't you know? Apparently everybody knows, except Radak thought that not everybody knew. But nonetheless, Yerushalmi thinks that this point is public. Amar lo, adayin monita demaran shaul kayam, to which she replied and said, our master Shaul's monitin is still around. Monitin can be a reference to currency or to reputation. It's very interesting. In modern Hebrew, they use monitin to refer to reputation. But it comes from the use of it to mean currency. There was, years ago, I gave a shiur in which this became relevant, and I found a column, I think it was in Haaretz or somewhere, where somebody had traced the etymology of the modern word monitin. It was fascinating. But anyway, she says, Shaul is still around. Va'ani amasecha. And then she says to David, I am only your maid. She calls herself your maid many, many times in this story. Melamed shetiva'a letashmish. That teaches that he propositioned her. Not for something right away, but for after Naval is dead. So, miyad hotzia kisma veherasalo. So at that point, she takes out this cloth with the blood on it, and she shows it to him. Amar lavachi rung summon balayla. He said, why did you bring that? Do we examine that at night? Amrule, which should be probably Amra, it's probably a typo. She said to him, lo yishmu aznecha mashapicha medaber. Don't your ears hear what your mouth is saying? Ksamim inuam balayla. We wouldn't examine a potential blood stain at night. The din in a fasho is done in balayla, but we're going to judge capital cases at night. So here his answer is different. Amar la, kvar nigmar dino mi ba'od yom. Don't worry, we took care of the judgment during the day. That's not a problem. Amra lo, and then she says, velosi ezos l'chale puka, amra bilezer pik puke devarim hayasham. There were verbal detractions there. I'm not going on with the verbal detractions right now. So, the Yerushalmi reads, Ani amasecha, I am your maid, as a response to say, I am not worthy of being with you. Which is consistent with what she's going to say at the end of the chapter, when he actually does want to marry her, and she says, who am I? I'm not worthy of this. Reminiscent also, since it's Shavuos shortly, of Ruth's response to Boaz. When he is willing to support her and she says, I am just your maid and you're treating me so nicely in the second parak. So there's actually a lot to say about the beauty of Abigail as well. I'm not going into it, but I did want you to see source number three on the sheet in which we are told there are four great, beautiful women in the world, and Abigail is listed as one of them. It's Sarah, Rahab, Abigail, and Esther. And then if you take the view that Esther wasn't naturally beautiful, so then take Esther off the list and add Vashti, so there, which I think is interesting also. But the big question you have to ask when you read this Gemara, either one, the Bavli or the Yerushalmi, is where did you get any of this? Like, what is this? The bloodstain? The discussion? The conversation? Like, what is this about? So clearly, the primary textual basis for this is what? I mean, I sort of indicated it in the translation on the sheet. Sorry?
The word dam is used.
Damim.
Plural? Right. The word damim being plural. Right? Abigail said twice that David should not commit violence. If you look in your Shmuel, chapter 25, sentence 26, Perichavei, Pasuk Chavav, she said, Mina'acha Hashem, mibo bidamim v'hoshea yad chalach. Hashem prevented you from entering into bloods, right? And then again, in sentence 31, she said, Lo siyazaz v'chalafuka u'mechsholev ladoni v'lishpoch dam chinam. To spill blood for nothing, lo shia donilo, and to save himself. So there's this emphasis twice on blood, and David echoed it, right? In Pasuk Lamed Gimel, when David responds in sentence 33, he says, Baruch ta'ameich, brucha ad asher kilisini hayom hazeh, mibo bidamim. You kept me from entering into bloods and saving myself with my might. So Abigail and David both emphasized damim, plural. We associate, in general, biblical references to dam, to blood, with particular mitzvos, like bris milah is one, and nida is another one. Like, for example, the Medrash on, if you remember your Haggadah, b'damayeh chayi, by your blood you shall live. So the Midrashim there say it's the blood of the Karim Pesach then, and it's the blood of Mila and the blood of Nida. So I think that's a lot of what is feeding this, as well as Baruch Tameich, blessed be your argument. They're giving her a legal argument. But the message that the Gemara is trying to give us with this read of blood and Nida and all of that fundamentally is that Abigail is clever. Whether her argument in the Bavli or the Rishalmi version, you know, is right, you know, especially if you take the Rishalmi version, that she actually anticipated David soliciting her, and she brought this along, where we're highlighting her cleverness, and we're also saying she is more righteous than David. Right? She is correcting him regarding judging in the Bavli, preventing wrongdoing in Yerushalmi. So we're highlighting her righteousness. We're explaining David's reversal and his statement of Baruch Ta'ameich. Why did David back down? We're giving another way to read why he backs down. And it fits with her being David's Nevi'ah, David's prophet. She is steering him on a proper path. That's, I think, what we're seeing. Just one second, Susan. Just wanted to note for you one medrash in source number 4. I didn't intentionally leave that untranslated. I'm not sure what that's about, but I'll translate it now. Tova haisa Abigail leDavid mikol hakarbanos sha'olam. The Shabbat-olam. The medrash in Tehillim says, Abigail was better for David than all the sacrifices in the world. She'ilu asa oso ma'ase shechashav la'asos le'naval. If David had done what he planned to do to Naval, ilu ayamakriv kol korbanos sheba olam lo hayu mechaprim lo, no sacrifice he would have brought would have atoned for it. If David had killed Naval in his anger, this is taking the view that David is wrong, obviously, for wanting to kill Naval. Remember, we had this whole discussion of why David was trying to do it. This is clearly taking the view that David is in the wrong. had David done that, no sacrifice would have helped him. Vehi basa elav umilatasu, and she came along and saved him. And so you get this pasuk in Tehillim in chapter 53, Lamanatzeach al machalas, shemachlalo kashem shakarbanos mochlin. She achieved mechila, forgiveness for David, the like karbanos do. Yes, Susan.
I'm thinking of what we get every time to the Omer. I read it every, you know?
Yeah.
Yesterday's or today's class, we'll talk about David liking beautiful people and forgiving them easier or being attracted to them more than non-beautiful people, like with Absalom and Ace. Anyways, so this seems to tie in with what we've been reading in the Omer about David being influenced by beauty.
Mm-hmm. I hear it. I'll tell you the truth. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying that, but the Gemara says that. So the Gemara's on your side.
I'm just tying in from what you're saying.
No, because like there's even more than I have brought here on Abigail's beauty and how that appeals to David. So you're not wrong. I'm just uncomfortable with it.
Oh, okay. But
you're wrong. Yeah. Yes, I do. Sandra and then Claudette, and I see a couple of other hands. We'll go around. Yeah, Sandra.
There's another connotation to damim in the Torah.
Yeah.
One of them, they're talking about if you find a thief of Akhterim, you know.
Right. Ein lo damim.
Ein lo damim, and also dachad rashcha.
Yeah.
Meaning it's your responsibility. So why could they not use that connotation, but going to all this midrash about
blood
and all that?
So I would say two things. Number one is that in the cases you just cited, it really doesn't mean responsibility, it means blood. We take that to mean responsibility, but in other words, when it says about the thief who breaks into the house, ein lo damim, it means he has no blood. He's not considered to be a life, and therefore the homeowner is entitled to defend himself by killing him, and that's why the pasuk continues to say, "Im zarcha alav hashemesh, damim la." Im zarcha hashemesh alav, damim la. If the sun shines on him, it's clear to you that he's not a threat. Then he does have damim. He does have blood.
Okay.
So that's number one. But number two, and I think equally important, is something that we've said on a few other occasions, which is, when a text uses a particular word or a particular turn of phrase, it's sometimes there's the logical read, and then the choice of word itself is meant to provide me with an extra layer of meaning. I'll give you an example. When Shaul first starts as king, it says that he is Ben Shana. It says something like, Ben Shana Shaul b'molcho. Shaul was a year when he became king. Everybody knows Shaul was not 1 year old when he became king. For starters, he has a son, Yehonasan, who is much older. Shaul obviously is not a year old when he becomes king. Rather, pshat in the pasuk is, he was in his first year as king. That doesn't stop the Midrashim from saying, he was as innocent as a 1 year old when he became king. Ah, but that's clearly not what the sentence means. Yeah, but the sentence chose to express itself in that way in order to give me an extra layer. And that's what I think the Midrash is picking up on here.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Claudette and then Etty.
I like the Midrash because it shows me that Abigail knows she has a legal mind. She cares with prop. She appealed to all of his senses, his ear, with all the talking. She had a prop. She also brought food. And she knew who she was talking to, because if you go back to when Samuel anointed David, God said, it's the one that sees. So she knew that he would recognize what she's doing.
Well, it wasn't that David is described as the one that sees. It was that Hashem is the one that sees, is the one who sees there.
The one that sees. Okay,
yeah.
But he anointed David.
But your point stands without...
Recognize that David had that skill within him.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Eti.
I may have lost something. The Talmud, Yerushalmi, and the other one.
Yeah.
Where did they get this piece of cloth done with blood and whatever?
So there, again, there.
Anywhere in the text, no.
So, no, it says it in the text, yes. The word damim, the repeated references to damim is what it's picking up on, combined with Baruch Tameich, which suggests that she made some kind of an argument that was appealing to him. That's what they're building on. You will not find the cloth mentioned. Absolutely, absolutely 100% true. But that's what they're building on.
But when she's saying damim, meaning that she came to plead not to kill her husband and his people and all her people.
And that's the simple read.
So that's what she means, like, you shouldn't steal all this blood. So
do you understand?
When this cloth and everything doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. Okay. I'm not going to try to convince you. I presented it. Okay. Should we go further? Okay. So, in sum, Abigail has acknowledged her family's guilt. She says, Hashem sent me in order to keep you from doing something that would come back to haunt you as king. David listens. He thanks her very much. Before we go further in the story, I want to come back to something that we've talked about off and on throughout this chapter. And I have this fellow Tal who emails me, who has really, you know, pushed me to enlarge my thinking on it, because you can't ignore the links here, which I put on your source sheet, David and Esav, right? We keep talking about that one. Abigail and Yaakov, and Naval and Laban. So what I want to do, and we're going to start this now, but have to continue it next week because there's too much to say, but what exactly is this and what are we supposed to get from it? So first of all, David and Yaakov and Naval and Lavan, right? You remember the story from Bereishis from chapter 31. Lavan has the two daughters, Rachel and Leah. Yaakov comes to the house. Yaakov falls for Rachel. He wants to marry Rachel. He's told you have to work for 7 years. He works for 7 years to marry Rachel. Lo and behold, he ends up marrying Leah by accident. Lavan says, all right, you can marry Rachel also, but that'll take another 7 years. So he marries Rachel, and then he works for another 7 years, for a total of 14. Then he's ready to leave. However, Lavan isn't so ready to send him away. In sum, after 20 years, he ends up fleeing with his family. Lavan has swapped and changed his salary a whole bunch of times to try to cheat Yaakov. Yaakov and his family flee. Rachel has taken the trafim. That's a side note in the story. And Lavan comes pursuing the family. He goes searching for the trafim. He doesn't find them. Yaakov lets him have it. Yaakov says, you didn't find any trafim because we don't have the trafim. Yaakov doesn't know. And then he launches into this major, major rant to Lavan about all the work he's been doing all this time on his behalf, and how much Lavan profited from him, and how Lavan tried to cheat him and not to pay him for it. And then ultimately there's a detente between them. That's the basic story. So the basic narrative already has similarities. Both Yaakov and David are fugitives, right? They both have issues with their father-in-law. They're both seeking support from a wealthy person in exchange for their services, and the wealthy person refuses to help, right? Just the basic, you know, similarities from the story. The text adds to that. First of all, Naval, Lavan, right? The same letters, just reversed. Lamed bet nun, nun bet lamed. I have to admit, I don't find that piece of it compelling, because honestly, if Naval were the exact opposite person in Tanakh, like if Naval was this really nice, sweet, generous person instead, I would say, aha, you see that? His letters are the opposite of Lavan because he's the anti-Lavan. So, whatever. The letters are what they are. From a personality perspective, we see it very clearly. Nabal's greed and Lavan's greed go hand in hand. And we've already noted from the writing of Rav Bazak that David's relationship with Nabal matches Yaakov's relationship with Lavan in Yaakov's speech to Lavan in Bereishis. It's I gave you the verse references here in source number 5 so that you could look it up rather than have us go looking it up right now. But take a look at source number 5. Number 1, we were told here, the Na'ar reported this, the Yud reported this, that Nabal's animals didn't lose anything. Nothing was lost when David's men were protecting them. Same thing, Yaakov says to Lavan, your animals didn't lose anything. You can go back to the pasuk, and I shouldn't do it by heart. The statement that was made by a youth to Abigail, that David's men protected Nabal's men day and night, is the same thing that Yaakov describes for himself. I was there at night, I was there by day, the whole bit. Also, Yaakov says to Lavan, you would have chosen, if you had had your druthers, you would have chosen not to pay me anything. Just like David says about Nabal, Vayashev li ra'a tachas tova, he paid me back with bad in place of good. There are also more similarities in the story that Rav Bazak notes. Both stories hit their peak at the shearing of the sheep. When Lavan goes to shear his sheep, that's when Yaakov and his family run away. This story here is when Nabal is having his sheep shorn, and that's when David sends his men to ask for payment. Also, we haven't seen this yet, both stories involve God intervening after 10 days. Meaning, the story of Yaakov and Lavan, Yaakov flees. On the third day, Lavan finds out that Yaakov's family has fled, and then Lavan spends 7 days catching up. Day 10 is when he meets them. In this story, Nabal, when he finds out what Abigail has done, is going to become ill for 10 days before Hashem takes his life. So it's 10 days and then Hashem's intervention. So with so much linking the two stories, it will not surprise anybody, especially Eti, that Midrashim capitalize on this connection. So take a look, please, at source number 6. For one example, in the Medrash on Tehillim, it's commenting on a pasuk, Lamanatzeach amut labein. Lamanatzeach to the conductor, on the deaf, labein. So this Medrash says it's actually referring to mitat Nabal, the death of Nabal. Ka'osios lavan, kein osios Nabal. It's the same letters. So if it was talking about Nabal's death, why did it say Labain? It should have said Nabal. Shehu dome b'masav l'Lavan, because it wants to hint that Nabal's deeds are like Lavan's deeds. That's one medrash. I brought you another example of it in source number 7, where the pasuk says, the text says, Amar Nabal b'libo. The Nabal says, the repellent one says in his heart, dot, dot, dot. So, Amar Rabbi Yudin b'shem Rabbi Simon, hu Nabal, hu Lavan. Nabal, Lavan, same person. Asohi didain, kasohi didain. The letters of this one are like the letters of this one. Ma Lavan haya ramai, af Nabal haya ramai. Just as Lavan was a deceiver, so Nabal was a deceiver. So the Midrashim pick up on it. Yes, Janine.
How was Nabal a deceiver? He didn't make a deal with David. He just, it wasn't that he said, take care of my animals and I'll give you my, he was just wicked.
Right, so that goes back to the point we've been seeing, going back to the beginning and David's initial reaction of La Sheker Shamarti, right? It was all false that I did this, for him.
Was there a deal? Lavan was an active deceiver.
Correct. No, what we're saying here is that there was no deal, and yet, the level of responsibility when you know someone has done chesed for you is like there is. Let me hold off on answering you further because it's going to be source number 9. So let me go through it in order. I just want to do it, you know, sort of connecting the dots. So we have seen the Yaakov David comparisons before, right? That we've discussed. David is a shepherd, like Yaakov is a shepherd. David suffers, as I mentioned, at the hands of Shaul, his father-in-law, and Yaakov suffered at the hands of his father-in-law, Laban. We compared also the relationship between Yaakov and Rachel and the relationship between David and Michal back in chapter 18. Except that Michal is the one who stated to love David. Remember, we talked all about that. Who does David love versus who loves David? We also noted from Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, and we're going to come back to it in probably next week, that David has a spiritual side, the Yoshevo Halim, the dweller of tents, that emerged back in chapter 16 when he was the musician for Shaul. It emerges in his songs to Hashem in Shmuel, and of course, in Tehillim as well. So, what are we supposed to take away from all this? I would say two things. I think the point of the comparison, first of all, is, and this is Rav Bazak's point, and it goes back to what Janine was asking about, is when we address the question of whether Naval owes anything to David, and whether David has a right to be outraged, we already said that David believes chesed must be rewarded. Right? We went all the way back to Ruth with that idea, and her chesed, and the chesed of Boaz. We've discussed it in terms of Barzillai Agiladi, who David is going to insist on rewarding. We haven't seen that in Shmuel Aleph, but I've mentioned it. David is going to insist on rewarding Barzillai, who helps him. David is going to look after people. He's going to reward Yavesh Gilad. It's so core to David that chesed has to be rewarded. Rav Bazak argues that by comparing Naval and Lavan, we're saying that yes, Naval has an obligation, as though there was an agreement with David like Lavan had with Yaakov. That's the idea. Take a look at source number 9. I'll read my English translation since we only have a couple of minutes. It seems that there is a meaningful difference between Naval and Lavan. Lavan was obligated to pay Yaakov, for Yaakov was his hired worker, with an explicit agreement between the two parties, as opposed to Naval, who seems not to have owed David anything, right, on the face of it. But this very opposition teaches there was no ethical justification for Naval's conduct. That's exactly the point. The relationship formed between David and his men and Naval's men should have been no less binding than explicit employment. Ignoring this obligation would be in the class of deception, and there's the line. Just as Naval was a deceiver, so Naval was a deceiver. Mind you, even as I say that, I think back to the fact that the message of Abigail was, if you did this, you would be a criminal. Right? So, the answer is probably, Naval is obligated, but David is not right for wanting to kill him for it. That's really what I would see. There is something in the middle. It's possible for somebody to welch on a contract without being liable for death. You know, that's where I would put this. And then you have the Mori B'Malchus question. It's the throne, fine. But that's lesson number one. Lesson number two is don't think of David as the aggressor. Meaning we're connecting David to Yaakov. Yaakov runs away from Lavan, right? Yaakov runs away from Lavan. David attacks Naval. And we're going to see in the beginning next week, God willing, that there seems to be an awful lot of Esav in David. Right? We've talked about that already in various ways. But the similarities to Yaakov suffering injustice at Lavan's hands are meant to say, don't view David as an aggressor. David is fundamentally, in this story, he's still the weaker party. He's still the victim. And I think that's part of the way that this, you know, that this structure is being presented, is to remind you, David, you know, we've been looking at David as being on the warpath for so long. That's the way it feels to us. But he's not. David is the victim in this. Clear? Okay. There's more to be said. We have to begin next time with the whole David and Esav, Abigail and Yaakov thing. So God willing, that'll be next week. For those of you who are in Thornhill for Shavuos, all of my shiurim over Shavuos are David-based, since the Rishalmi tells us that David passed away on Shavuos. So I'm drawing heavily on stuff we've done, some of it from the Tuesday Malachim shiur as well. You're more than welcome to follow me through Thornhill, Shavuos night. We've got shiurim in a bunch of places on different aspects of the story, and it would be good to have company. And those who are not going to be in Thornhill, so print your notes out before Yantif and you can do a review.
Was David also born on Shavuos?
I don't know about him being born on Shavuos, only about him passing away on Shavuos. It's based on Psukim and Divrei Hayom Aleph Perek Chaf Tes. Okay.
Rabbi Georgina, I want to take this opportunity before Shavuos.